You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm right.
I'm sorry, but I cannot believe the call. You've got Marshawn Lynch in the backfield. I can't believe the call.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
Hello, and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports narratives. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. Across from me is not Neil Payne. Neil is on vacation this week, but we'll be back next. But we have the wonderful Caitlin Kelly here instead. Hi, Caitlin.
Hi, Chad. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good.
Caitlin is the online sports editor at The New Yorker and perhaps the world's greatest sports tweeter. Caitlin, we're all envious of your remarkable tweeting ability.
Oh, no. I'm blushing.
And also not New York, but in Los Angeles on a little video screen, Kate Fagan. Kate, how's the LA life treating you?
Hi, Chad. It's good. I'm going surfing right after this.
All right. Good. Kate, of course, is an ESPNW columnist and the third spoke in our Hot Takedown wheel. Guys, today's show, very excited. Double header for NBA. First, we're going to talk about the NBA playoffs. Then we're also going to talk about the NBA draft and sort of how to fix it, perhaps, and the lottery. And then, for the first time, amazingly, on a show about hot takes is the Eminence Grease of hot takes. Tim Tebow is going to make his first appearance on Hot Takedown. And then Significant Digits, Allison McCann, will join us to talk about the MLS. But first, to the NBA playoffs. They're here. They're going to be here for a long time. It's like a two-month slog, so it sometimes can feel like a slog. And the first round has started. Nothing too crazy has happened yet. No huge surprises. A couple of five seeds have won a game against a four seed. But for the most part, things are holding as we expected. And it seems to me like there's no more intriguing series than the Spurs and Clippers. The Spurs had the number two seed wrapped seemingly in their control going into the final day of the season, but they lost their final game and the Rockets won, and so the Rockets got the two seed and the Spurs dropped down to six. And Sir Charles Barkley thinks that that has been such a severe drop that the Spurs maybe now sabotage themselves.
When you look at these teams, I thought the Spurs, when they lost that two seed last game of the season, I think that killed them. And I think this is the year the Clippers have got to put up a shut up, or they got to break this team up.
So when Neil Payne, in absentia, ran some projections using 538's power rankings model, the Spurs are still favored to win against the Clippers. They have a 53% chance to win. And so, Caitlin, in a Western Conference this packed, with this many good teams, does it really matter what seed you are going into the first round?
No, I don't think so. It is almost arbitrary where these teams end up, and they've been playing each other all season. I think it's almost like the Western Conference is so evenly matched and so good that by the time you get to the postseason, it's more of the same, and everyone's just watching the Western Conference because the East is garbage.
I mean, I do think that what's important for the Spurs has always been the way the rhythm of the season goes for them, and Popovich being really smart about when to rest guys and creating spaces where they can rest guys. And even going into these playoffs, I thought the number two seed was important for them because they would have played the Dallas Mavericks, who had been playing better basketball but seemed to have a lot of issues of their own with Rondo at point guard and clashing with Carlisle, and it looked like an opportunity where the Spurs could pick up some rest time, because I don't think the Spurs can go through playoffs the way they have in the past 6 years, and especially last year, and play six, seven game series starting in the beginning. That's the one thing that I think is important about the fact that they landed in this series with the Clippers, who I think are going to give them much more of a battle than we would have seen against the Dallas Mavericks. So I am concerned. I mean, I think obviously it's ridiculous to say after one loss that the Spurs shot themselves in the foot. But I do think it's important to keep an eye on whether they're going to be able to create a rhythm and a space for themselves in the playoffs to get guys rest, because the Spurs cannot be worn down the way some younger teams can go through these playoffs. And, you know, like Jimmy Butler is going to play 46, 48 minutes.
But aren't the playoffs sort of built for somewhat older teams in that there's an off day after almost every game? And so it's a bit – there are no back-to-backs the way that there is in the NBA regular season. And so if there's ever a time where the Spurs could maybe get a little bit of advantage because they have these veterans, it would be now, right, Kate?
Yeah, I mean, certainly the scheduling helps them in a way that the NBA regular season is just not built for a team like the Spurs. But as we talk about, the playoffs and the style of those games is vastly different than the regular season. It's of course, one extra day. It's hard to balance what one extra day means when you're playing a very physical, tough game in a way that a lot of regular season games aren't. So it's tough to say whether it's offsetting by getting that extra day of rest or not because of the way, like you said, you called them a slog. It wasn't just like, oh, we have to talk about it for 2 months. It's because it's the longest epic playoffs in professional sports, in the number of games these teams play and the number of really, like, intense moments they have.
Yeah, and I think that just comes down to already we're seeing how much injuries have affected different teams post-seasons, especially with the Hawks. And with the rhythm that the Spurs have right now with their starting five, it would be pretty disastrous, I think, if one of them was taken out of commission because of an injury or strain.
Yeah, when you look at the real plus minus of the Spurs starters, aside from Tony Parker, all of them are well above league average, and that's not the case for every playoff team. It is, interestingly, the case for the Clippers, where every single one of their starters, but none of their main bench players, are above average. And for real plus minus here, what I mean is that it's similar to a plus minus score that you think of when you think of whether someone has a good or bad impact when they're on the court or off the court. But here it's adjusted for their teammates and for who they're playing and all sorts of other factors. So it's a bit more robust of a metric than just if you compared an Eastern Conference team to a Western Conference team. It takes those different quality of play into account. So guys, let's talk about Greg Popovich for a little bit. The question that comes to my mind is whether he's the Tom Izzo of the NBA. We spent a lot of time talking about Tom Izzo on this podcast in March and in early April, and I wonder whether we think that Popovich really does have some magic. The other way to put it that isn't mysticized is like a market advantage. Has he figured out a way to get his team to be good in the postseason in a way that other people haven't?
I mean, I don't know firsthand. I like many, have not talked to Popovich for very
long
or at
all. I don't
think
he would talk to you if he tried, given his mid-game press conferences.
But year after year, even when the odds are relatively stacked against him, the Spurs just somehow manage to come out and be, you know, a major player in the postseason. So it seems as close to what we have as NBA magic these days.
Yeah, I mean, the Spurs, as much as you can say that Popovich is responsible for the way these Spurs play, I mean, you have to talk also about where they've been able to get guys in the draft, and a lot of that is on their front office, which has picked up guys like Tony Parker and Ginobili in spaces in the draft that other franchises have just completely missed on guys. So that's part of it. But I do think if you're talking about Izzo as Popovich as like the Izzo, I think that's a pretty accurate comparison, because the way these Spurs play, right, it's like a philosophy that Popovich has somehow instilled in them, and it's like whoever they get ends up filling a specific role. I mean, you've seen guys come into the Spurs who other places in the league, they don't really know their role and they can't capitalize on that skill, and then these guys land in San Antonio and he has somehow created some sort of space for them where exploiting talents in a way that other teams in the league don't. And that's kind of what you see Michigan State do. I mean, not like specific comparison, but you see Michigan State recruit guys who maybe aren't the one-and-doners, but somehow everybody that they bring in is filling a really important role for the team. And for me, that's like the main comparison, as well as the fact that somehow the Spurs are ready come game time, come postseason, in a way Michigan State seems to be when the NCAA tournament starts.
Right. So last year when the Spurs went on their run to the NBA championship, Nate Silver, my boss, did a calculation of how good the Spurs were against the spread in Vegas and how often they exceeded what the spread should. And theoretically, the spread should cover them because it's a market-based that they should beat the spread about half the time. That is because it's a market-based point spread that's being set, and so it should equalize. But instead, what we saw was that Popovich, since 1997-98, has won 53.5% of the games against the spread. And in the playoffs, it's 55.9%. So he does get better against expectation in the playoffs. And that suggests to me that maybe there is some of this magic or whatever we want to call it there. And Kate, I wonder if that, you know, do you think that there's something about playoff basketball that systems really do win out? And we talked about this a lot in college basketball, but is there something about playoff basketball in the NBA that maybe suggests that having a system like Popovich does brings more likelihood of success?
For me, the reason the Spurs are so good in the playoffs is it's more about the way Popovich rests his guys and the way he prepares them for the postseason in terms of their bodies and time and minutes spent. I mean, there was all kinds of discussions over the last month or two about how, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, guys like Bird and Isaiah Thomas like played all 82 games and they played all these minutes and they played all the way throughout the playoffs. And somehow now, because you see, and Popovich was really the coach in the NBA who started using this philosophy, starting sitting guys, you know, like if he didn't need Tim Duncan, he sat him throughout the year. If he didn't need Ginobili, Parker, I mean, he would sit all three sometimes. And then it jumpstarts this discussion about whether fans, they've paid to see the game, whether this is right. How come this generation can't play all 82 games the way a previous generation did? But that has worked for the Spurs because they have an older, mature roster. So that's why I think they're more successful in the playoffs, is because they have a veteran roster. And usually franchises that have a veteran roster have worn them down and they're tired. So whatever benefit you would have with their maturity is offset by the fact that they've been driven into the ground throughout the year. So Popovich has, I think, found this sweet spot where he's got a mature roster, and the negative would be that they were tired and slow, but he's found a way to keep their minutes low and keep their games played low so that the maturity part shines through.
So before we go and talk about the Warriors, our projection said that the Spurs were 53% to win the series before they lost the first game. Now you guys have a little bit of a handicap. Do you think that the Spurs, that Pop Magic, is still going to win out against the Clips?
I'm not sure.
I don't think the Spurs are going to win this series. I don't.
After all this we just gave Popovich, now we're turning our back on him.
I mean, I think, you know, the magic he's been able to create over the last few years, which has gone against the logic. I mean, whoever's running their training room and keeping guys healthy, that dude, I'm assuming it's a dude, right, deserves a raise. Because that's been part of their magic, is just keeping guys somehow who are like 34, 35 playing as if they're 28 or 29. But I don't think they're going to win this. But that to me is more about Los Angeles and where they are right now and what they need to accomplish this year, with CP3 being in at the end of like his prime age to compete for a championship, and having Blake Griffin and Doc Rivers. It's kind of like it's their moment now, next year. Like if they can't get out of the first round this year, like that team over the next year or two is going to have to change course.
Kaylin, what's your deep thought about the Clips?
I agree with what Kate is saying. It does feel like it's kind of a now or if not never, but you know, it's going to be this year, or they're going to have to change something that could take a few seasons to gel and reach kind of this level of play again.
So let's talk about the Warriors, the best team in the NBA by far, it seems. Our model that I was talking about earlier give them a 48% chance of winning the whole championship. And wanted to get your guys' thoughts about whether or not that feels like it sort of jibes with what we saw during the season. I mean, they're not likely to win the championship, but they are by far the favorites too. Kaylin, as you watch the Warriors, do you see the makings of a team that feels like they fit in with an NBA champ?
Oh, definitely. I think, you know, just they were so dominant all season, and it was also in the way that they were dominant. It's not just, you know, Curry shooting threes and making them. It's they're a really great team on defense, and they also, they can adapt to different sets defenses and styles in a way that's really fun to watch and interesting to watch, but in a way that resulted in 67 wins.
Right. I mean, the Warriors are 94th percentile in defense and 94th percentile in offense relative to the rest of the league. And so it's a very balanced team. Kate, I know you were burning to talk about Steph Curry and the crew. What do you got?
I was. Well, when I launched that 538 article and I scrolled to the bottom first and was kind of going up through, and it was like, you know, most of these teams have like either negative 1% chance, right? If it's like the Brooklyn Nets or the Boston Celtics, or like, you know, 2-3% chance. And Cavs obviously were a little higher. And then I get to the top and I thought that 48%, at first it blew me away because I don't think of the Warriors as big of a favorite as I thought of Kentucky going into the NCAA tournament, right? And like Kentucky supposedly blew out the model at 41%. Like when we had Nate in here, he was like, basically they're maxed out, right? I mean, this is like the highest percentage we've seen for an NCAA team. And so I was like, wow, like the Warriors 48% is really high. But the interesting thing when you start to think about that is that like the model of NBA playoffs allows for much greater likelihood that the better team is going to win each series, as opposed to in the NCAA where there's just so many variables when you bring it down to one game. So it does make sense that they're at 48%. And like mentally, I would think that number would even be higher when it comes to like pundits and talking heads and media. It would be higher if they had a player on their roster, like a star on their roster who had won an NCAA title before. If they were playing a style of basketball that we had seen win before. But I think when you just break down the numbers, it that seems higher than people are talking about them, because we have this disconnect between, if we haven't seen a team like the way the Warriors play win, then we can't think of them as the favorite, right? You'll always hear people say, well, LeBron, right? LeBron and the Cavs. LeBron's won twice. Therefore, somehow Cleveland is of more of a favorite.
But here's the interesting thing about this year's playoffs, especially in the Western Conference. It does feel like it's a bit of a referendum on this analytics-minded basketball, where you have the Warriors, who shoot lots of threes, play good defense. You have the Rockets, who drive to the basket, shoot lots of free throws, shoot lots of threes, and depending on how James Harden's feeling, play okay defense. To Kate, to your point, and Kate and I wonder if you have thoughts about this, it does seem like in the NBA we're constantly looking for models of victory, and that we don't believe that a new one is possible until it's there. And then all of a sudden it becomes like the blueprint for teams for the next 5 years.
I think that just plays into human nature as well. I think that's not specific to NBA basketball or basketball. I think you see that across all leagues. And it can take a while for the analytics to get off. But I think when you see results like the Warriors, I think I agree to Kate's point that people won't really be giving them the credit and predicting them to take everything until they do. I mean, you know, I think that people would be more likely next season to predict the Warriors.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I always think about this story I was working on about Natalie Nicasse, who before Becky Hammon was hired by the Spurs, was kind of in training within the Clippers to possibly be the first female assistant coach in the NBA. And I talked to Daryl Morey, the GM of the Houston Rockets, just about the likelihood of a program, a franchise hiring a female assistant coach. And I was like, why has it not happened? And he's like, they haven't hired a woman because nobody's hired a woman. And his logic was basically like, that's what it's like in the NBA. You can't go to your owner and be like, I want to shake things up, or I want to, you know, I want to sign this guy. I want to make this team this model. And that owner, he said, will always say, well, show me where it's worked before. I want to see a model that's worked. And it was like that, and this is tangentially related, it was like that with hiring Natalie Nicasse or Becky Hammon. It was like, until a team did it, all the teams weren't going to do it because nobody had done it. And it's like that with how models work in on the court in the NBA. Like, we look at the Golden State Warriors and we're like, man, they look like they should win, but I've never seen them win. I've never had it happen. I can't picture it. Therefore, that's a knock against them.
And then also sometimes people say that it's only because they have such good players that fit that model perfectly, but you couldn't like translate it over to an inferior team with inferior players.
Right, which is a weird sort of logic to use, right? Because it's like I'm assuming they've created a blueprint or a plan. And again, maybe it happened organically. Maybe they weren't like, look, we want to play this style of basketball. Maybe they ended up having players available in the draft like Klay Thompson and be like, hey, we are going to have to tailor our style of play to the guys we have, which to me seems like the smart thing to do in the NBA. But the problem often is that instead of going that route, drafting players that are just the best available and then seeing what style you should play, it's usually like, we need a 3-superstar model. And we're going to, like, shoehorn in who is supposed to work instead of being like, hey, let's build naturally and then fit a style around the talent we have.
Okay, so let's press pause on the NBA for now so that we can have a word from our sponsor, and then we'll be back with the NBA lottery. Our sponsor this week is SeatGeek, the smartest way for fans to save money on sports tickets. You may have noticed this week that my voice is as hoarse as Gus Johnson's, and that's because I spent most of the weekend at Citi Field to watch the 10-3 Mets be the 10-3 Mets. Very excited about this Mets 8-game winning streak. I was sitting there looking at all the people who were also at the game and got to thinking at how much they paid for their tickets. You can have the same seat these days for wildly different prices, depending on where you got it or how much you got ripped off for. And SeatGeek can help with that. It harnesses all sorts of data to give you a range of ticket prices, aggregating tickets from every major ticket site online and taking into account historical ticket prices, the day of the week, who the opponent is, etc. This week, you can use promo code TAKEDOWN on the SeatGeek app and get a $20 rebate off your first SeatGeek purchase. All you have to do is download the app, enter the promo code before you buy your tickets, and SeatGeek will then send you $20 once you've actually bought the tickets. That's promo code TAKEDOWN. The SeatGeek app is your ticket to sports this April. So on the other side of the playoffs, there are 14 teams who are at home, and they're waiting for the lottery to begin. A few of them maybe have been there all along. The T-Wolves, Knicks, and Sixers were the worst three teams in the league this year, and you can make a good argument that at least two of them wanted to be that low so they could pick up better draft picks in this year's draft. Adam Silver thinks that that framing is a little too cynical, and so here he is talking outside the lines about tanking in the NBA.
I absolutely don't think any team is trying to lose, and I'm talk directly to the players, and you know our players. They're the most competitive people in the world, so I don't think there's any question.
What about management?
Well, okay, but so I don't just on the players. No player is going out there to lose. In terms of management, I think there's an absolute legitimate rebuilding process that goes on. It's so hard to win in this league, and it's so complex, and I think what's happened in the case of Philadelphia, their strategy has been reduced into a tweet, this notion that, you know, be bad to be good.
But guys, teams are trying to lose, right? Like I feel like listening to that Adam Silver thing, I felt like reality was not what I thought it to be. Am I wrong to think that when the Knicks trade away J.R. Smith and Iman Shumpert and start, I mean, guys who I couldn't name this season, let alone in 10, that means they're trying to lose? Caitlin, am I wrong?
No, and I believe that teams are actively trying to lose, but I also think Adam Silver has a product to sell, and that's what he was doing right there. And, you know, especially teams like the Knicks where you can be making $1 million at the gate per game, people aren't going to buy those tickets if they know the team is out there to lose. So you never are going to see someone like him, or I think even many GMs admit it, but it can't be denied that that's the strategy.
I love how in the NBA over the last couple of years, they've started to like parse out that question and the language in it, because obviously nobody thinks this is like a shoeless Joe Jackson situation happening where like guys are actually players are out on the court, not playing hard. But that's the go-to line now. If you're like, well, Sixers are trying to lose. It's like, oh, no, they're not trying to lose. And you're ignoring the part of the question you heard him in that. Ignore. Like, they're like, no, what about management? He's like, oh, I'm talking about the players. Okay, well, you have this standard line to say, well, nobody's trying to lose. But of course, of course they're trying to lose. That's even a model, right? That's a model going off of what we were talking about with the Warriors. I mean, that's a model that everybody has sort of adopted because supposedly it's worked for Oklahoma City Thunder, right? They've played poorly, whether on purpose or not, but not on purpose, right? They just have guys out there who aren't as good at basketball as the other guys on the court. And then they get draft picks. And then, you know, they capitalize on those draft picks and make good draft picks. So, of course, it's a strategy. And there's an argument to be made that the storylines that emerge in the how much we talk about losing and the lottery and college players and who's going to be a superstar in itself is a marketable asset for the NBA. Yeah, it looks bad to lose and to have a franchise quote-unquote tanking, but at the same time, it's interesting. And I think the NBA is not stupid. They know that this creates storylines for them in a different unique way.
And part of the way that it creates storylines is that they have these mad geniuses like Sam Hinkie in Philadelphia, or these people who are purported to be mad geniuses. And so there's a mystique around losing. Because if the Sixers, and we've talked about the Sixers before on this podcast, can turn it around, then all of a sudden it was worth something. And then, as Kate's pointing out, maybe there is a model to this.
It also, it just seems like it's just more of a topic of conversation year after year in a way. I don't remember. It's like, who's going to be the team tanking this year? As you know, as if it's just inevitable that someone is going to be doing that.
Right. Who's
going to
be the hot team in the league? Who's going to be the tanking team in the league?
And what player in from college are they going to be after this time?
But okay, so let's talk about how to fix it, because Adam Silver has said that he's aware that maybe something's up. Our ESPN colleague at Grantland, Zach Lowe, has reported in depth about various different ways. And so before we get into into two main avenues, I want to ask you guys whether or not you think it's in a league's interest to have parity or dynasty, which is to say, should the league be compensating, be giving a handicap to teams that lose a lot? Should they have more balls in the lottery, for example? Or should it be a random thing where everyone gets their shot at it?
Well, I don't think it's mutually exclusive. Like, if you look at the NFL, there's a lot of parity, and you could also say that the New England Patriots are a bit of a dynasty, right, over the last 12 years. So in a league in parity, like, teams still can set themselves apart. I don't think it has to be one or the other. I just think there should be a punishment for being the worst team in a league. I think you're going to have to look at, like, the EPL, the English Premier League, or any, you know, international soccer league as a model with having relegation. And maybe you can't do that, because what would you do? You'd, like, send teams down to the D League, and that's not going to happen. But instead of rewarding teams who are bad and, like, consistently trying to, like, fiddle around with the nitty-gritty of what that looks like. And I think there are some really interesting solutions about how to, like, change those numbers. But at the same time, like, well, then how can you dissuade it with, like, some sort of punishment for a team, you know, that would actively keep them from needing to tank?
Yeah, I agree that the incentive structure that the league has right now is a little backwards. And if not necessarily totally backwards, it's just like, once you're in that bottom 2 to 3 teams, it's what are you actually striving for and to do with the rest of the season? It's going to be to try to get those picks.
And so one of the ideas floated is what's called the wheel, which is every team has sort of a random slot where they get to pick the first pick, and maybe it's weighted in certain ways. That seems to have fallen out of favor a little bit. I feel like I've heard about that less in the last couple of years. My boss, Nate Silver, offered what seems to me to be a compromise solution, which is that, so what he identified was that there's too big of a gap in between the worst team and the second worst team as far as the extra balls they get in that giant bat when the lottery is picked. And so right now the worst team gets 250 balls, and the second worst, in this case the Knicks, get 199. Okay, and so the worst team here is the Timberwolves, so they have a 25% chance of getting the first pick. The Knicks have only 19.9% chance, and yet they were only separated by one loss. And so his thought was, through various ways of anchoring the team's losses to the mean, we don't need to get into that, that you end up shrinking the advantage of the worst team. And so maybe that's the subtle cue that teams need to stop losing so much. So in Nate's world, the worst team would get 22% chance of a first pick, and the second worst, 20.3. And so what was a 5.1 percentage point gap becomes a 1.7 percentage point gap. And so do we think that that's all it will take, is a subtle sort of adjustment of the rules, or do we need to blow the system up?
Well, I think that helps, like, make the problem a little bit more, like, palatable. I don't think it solves anything because you're not dissuading teams from being down at the bottom and hopefully getting more ping pong balls. And that's the core of the problem, is that teams are trading off players and tanking at the bottom to get more ping pong balls. I think it does solve the strange nature of, like, if we're the absolute worst, even though we were only, like, even one game worse than the next worst, we get this higher chance, and therefore it's like everybody plummeting in a new way. I think it keeps teams from, like, completely, like, dropping the anchor, but it doesn't keep teams from wanting to be down there when it's quote-unquote necessary for them.
I feel like the way that maybe perversely the league would accept the strategy is because it would prevent fans at the end of the season from, like, rooting for their team to lose to get that last chance. I feel like that's always kind of a weird look when everyone's like, oh, how could you possibly win that last game of the season? And now, you know, we have so many less ping pong balls in the back.
Right. What sparked Nate to write it was that the Knicks won at a particularly inopportune moment.
That's what I was thinking.
And as a result, do have a pretty significant difference in their ability to get the first pick now than they would have before. Okay, so clearly we've solved it all, so we can move on to Tim Tebow, I think, right, guys? You feel like Adam Silver needs what he got out of that, or got what he needs out of that? Okay, so Tebow, he's back, guys. I'm super excited.
He's back. He's risen, almost.
It's almost as though he's
And this
risen.
Is why. It's because the jokes are so easy.
I know. It really is. And so I'm a Jets fan. And when Tebow first came to the Jets, I wrote in a former life when I wrote more, I wrote a piece, I think for New York Magazine, about why it was so great that Tebow was a Jet. Was because football, unlike baseball, which is a daily soap opera, football is a weekly drama. And you get super excited all weekend long. You sit down, you watch your program, right? You watch your show. And then you spend the next 3 days talking about it. About what happened on the last episode. You read some recaps, you know, you read the fan gossip about spoilers or whatever, what might happen this season. And then for the next 3 days, you're excited about the next episode happen. And what's so great about Tebow is he provides the most amazing storyline for that weekly drama possible. And so now it's the Eagles weekly drama, because Tim Tebow has signed to a 1-year deal to be the backup quarterback with Chip Kelly's Eagles. And for now, I guess we assume it's going to be a backup quarterback, right? Do you guys think it's safe to say that Sam Bradford is actually going to start for the Eagles and it's not going to be Tim rising from the back?
Or he could be the backup to the backup, right?
Right. Sorry, yeah. He could be the third string.
Third string.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
And so this brings up the question of whether it matters who your third string quarterback is. Third string quarterbacks, you know, from advanced stats, have very little bearing on a team until the other two quarterbacks perhaps go out. And so my question is whether, like, given that it's sort of something you have to have on your roster in case of emergency, but probably aren't going to need it unless an emergency arises, doesn't it make sense to bring in a guy with versatile skills like Tebow?
It does. I think Bill Barnwell just wrote about this for Grantlands, and where I see it being an issue for the Eagles is that you have three quarterbacks that need to learn Chip Kelly's system, basically. And for every minute that you're trying to spend with Tebow and making sure that your third string quarterback is fine, you know, that's a minute less you're spending with the quarterbacks that you actually need to have ready for the season. And I think it would have made more sense for Chip Kelly to go looking for a third string quarterback who would fit his system. And maybe that wouldn't be someone with a flashy name, but it would probably work better.
I mean, it seems like either there's another shoe that's going to drop, right, with the Eagles when it comes to NFL draft time, and of course Marcus Mariota and all of the whispers that the Eagles still care about him. Let's assume these are the three QBs. I mean, it's Sam Bradford is the starter in that group. And then the question is, like, why do you have Tebow? Do you have Tebow because you think he's occasionally a good option on, like, a goal line play or a third and one and you want to run something? I mean, he's not going to be your guy when it's, like, third and eight. And it confuses me a little bit because there are occasional moments, like the St. Louis Rams last year when they had to go all the way down the depth chart at QB, where you wish you had somebody already on the roster that knew the system. But for the most part, you want a versatile third string QB. By that, I mean, like, you're caring more about, like, punt coverage and kickoff. And is there a guy there, that is versatile and can do all those things? So it makes me wonder if Tim Tebow is going to be that guy for them. He's always said that he'll only play QB, but are we missing something here in terms of, like, is he going to now be on special teams? Right? Because a lot of times that 53rd spot on the roster, it's important that you have good coverage, good punt coverage, good kickoff coverage. Because if he's just this guy that you're using for like a total of 7 plays throughout the year, that doesn't make sense. But if he's a guy that is going to do more for them, then maybe, and we'll have to see this, then maybe it makes sense that you've got very strong, athletic, powerful guy who can be versatile for you on special teams.
And we've seen the Jets try and just use him 7 plays a year, and it didn't work. But, Kate, you said that that bringing him in on 38 may not make sense, but in Barnwell's piece that Caitlin mentioned, there's an argument that because of Tim Tebow's arm strength, that maybe he is the guy you want in on 3rd and 8th, and he maybe becomes something like a third-down quarterback instead of a third-down running back occasionally. Go ahead, Kate.
Well, yeah, I mean, it makes sense as a third-down quarterback when it's 3rd and short, because his strength comes in the fact that he can run that option. And so if you've got DeMarco Murray back there with him, maybe he's more of a threat to run than Sam Bradford coming off an injury, although Sam Bradford was good at running at Oklahoma. But it makes sense as like a goal line or 3rd and short, but when it's 3rd and 8, it's hard to think they're doing anything but passing. And then you want a guy who's going to be able to like throw it over the middle on target and thread the needle, and Tebow's not that guy. So he gives you versatility in 3rd and short, but I don't think he gives you versatility or you're wanting to bring him in at 3rd and long.
Right, so Neil Greenberg at Washington Post had some stats about Tebow's accuracy and QB rating when he rushes a pass, when he stays for a long time in the pocket or if he's quick. And so there's some discussion about, because Chip Kelly's so ardent about fast, hurry-up offenses, that Tebow will be okay if he ever gets in the game, because on when he spends 2.5 seconds or less in the pocket, his QB rating is 30 points better, and his completion percentage is 25 percentage points better. And so maybe there's some universe in which the good Tebow can come out and not the bad Tebow, and Chip Kelly is the mad genius who can figure out how to build that system for him.
Yeah, there's just the one thing I can't wrap my head around with this decision is just it's been so long since Tim Tebow has played in the NFL, and I feel like over the past few years, just the league has changed in that there's more read option than there used to be, and defenses are used to having that too, and I feel like it might be harder for Tim Tebow to come back into that kind of game than it might have been even a year ago or two ago.
So I don't want to talk about Tim Tebow without talking about capital T Tim, capital T Tebow, which is to say the myth, the legend, and why it is that Tim Tebow gets people so crazy and so many hot takes. And listen, this is an ESPN podcast. We are well aware of ESPN's love for Tim Tebow. Let's not forget, Tim Tebow was an ESPN employee until he signed this deal with the Eagles. Skip Bayless has a love affair with him. Such a love affair that someone online created an auto-tuned version of Skip giving a hot take about Tebow.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got Tebow. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win games.
Listen.
I got Tebow. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is unleash.
So Tebow, let him go.
It's time.
Turn him loose.
Let him play.
On Sunday.
So Tim Tebow, that is basically an ode to Skip Bayless's hot takes on Tim Tebow. That's how many hot takes there have been. What is it about this guy? What do you think?
There's something about it. He's just so nice. I think he has kind of, he doesn't come with a whole lot of baggage that makes it difficult to joke about him.
What do you mean by baggage?
He hasn't committed any crimes that I know of. So I think he is kind of an easy target in a way that you don't have to overthink what you're saying. And I think that is the essence of the hot take. And that is why he's the subject of so many of them.
I think his fervent religious belief does have something to do with why he's so relevant and why, yes, we cover him a lot at ESPN. We get made fun of for that, but people talk about him and people want to hear about him. And in large part, it's because he's polarizing. And I don't mean that he says divisive things. I just mean his very existence is polarizing. And there's a significant portion of this country, right, that holds the same beliefs as Tim Tebow. And I don't think that that population in the sports world necessarily has a lot of, like, icons that they can relate to. And I think Tim Tebow provides them one. So there are a lot of people who love him and who love what he stands for and will click on anything about him and read about him because they don't have, there aren't a ton of, certainly athletes say a lot, like, I want to thank God after a game, but there are, that doesn't always translate to somebody living a Christian lifestyle and being so open about it as Tim Tebow is. So he is an icon for a very significant population in this country. He also kind of represents like the everyman as much as an NFL player can, because he's obviously he has a lot of like natural abilities that the everyman wouldn't have. But in relation to NFL players, he's kind of like the everyman's hero. Like if guys would picture themselves like, here's what I would be like in the NFL. I would try hard and I would just like be such a leader. I mean, that's who Tim is. So instead of having like, you know, a 6'7" receiver who can run a crazy 40 and jump really high, you got this white dude who tries really hard. And I think there's a significant portion of the population that can relate to that.
So you're saying he wouldn't be as popular if he were better?
Right. Well, he would still be wildly popular because this Christianity mm-hmm. that he embodies would still be relevant to people, and people who, you know, didn't necessarily, you know, weren't faith-based would still have something to argue about. But I'm saying that the storyline day in and day out is like, what are we going to see from Tim Tebow this week? And that's interesting to people.
But isn't there something to the idea that his early play with the Broncos in particular felt almost as miraculous as some of the stuff in his religion that he tries to evangelize, which is like to say that the Broncos were bad before Tim Tebow came along, and then all of a sudden they were good, and there's all sorts of reasons about that, and plenty of analytics folks have shown that it probably wasn't Tebow. It was a running game and a defense getting really good at it about that time. But there is a sort of twinning of narrative between what his own personal life and his football life, at least in that first year, and that I think built up, as well as at Florida obviously, that built up this legend of Tebow, and we haven't ever been able to get away from that because then basically his career it got frozen in amber after that because he's basically not been on the field because he's not good enough to be on the field.
Yeah, and it is kind of interesting what you're saying, frozen in amber. I think that kind of has something to do with it too, almost like, you know, the Tim Tebow story is not done yet, or so, you know, there I think maybe that's part of the reason why there is so much hunger for that storyline to continue. And then going back to Cade's point about his beliefs, and I think especially like the sincerity, not just that he holds in those beliefs, but that he, I think, and also about, you know, trying so hard to be better at football and, you know, having, even while he wasn't on an NFL team, training to get back to an NFL team. I think that's something that people can really identify with and want to root for. And I think there's also a small segment of people on the internet and on TV who, you know, that's also something that puts a big target on Tim Tebow's back, too, just to be snarky and make fun of. So I think it goes kind of both ways.
Right. There's sort of a feedback loop that starts of people loving him, and there's a feedback loop of the backlash to that. And then, of course, there's a backlash to the backlash, and it all feeds into itself.
And we're in, like, the 5,000th loop of that.
Right. Okay, so let's keep it there for Tebow and welcome in Allison McCann, our maven of significant digits. Allison, thanks for coming back to the show. What do you have for us today?
So I have first as the significant digit, which I guess technically is like an ordinal number, not really a digit, but whatever. So anyway, first is the place in the Eastern Conference that the New York Red Bulls of Major League Soccer find themselves in after 5 games this season. Maybe this doesn't sound too surprising, given that the Red Bulls were a good team last year. They finished 4th in the Eastern Division. and they lost in the conference finals. But in the offseason, the hot takes were really rolling in. They lost Thierry Henry to retirement. Tim Cahill, the famous Australian who scored a crazy goal in the World Cup, he left. They fired their coach, and a new New York City franchise, the NYCFC, had opened up to much fanfare. So everybody was really ragging on the Red Bulls. And now here they are, you know, a couple weeks into the season. It's still early, but they're sitting in first place. And, yeah, I just think it's really fun. It's a good story for the MLS of, yeah, losing a lot of their superstars and this team doing well. That's kind of, you know, the lesser cool franchise of New York City. And
I don't think I've ever watched a full MLS game, shamefully. Caitlin, it sounds like you maybe did.
I've only watched a few. Actually, one of New Yorker's writers, Paul Eli, had a piece this week, or was it? It was last week, about going to an NYCFC game. They actually play in Yankee Stadium for you know, conceivable futures. We don't really know what the arena plans are for NYCFC yet. Paul went into, you know, the team being launched thinking that he was going to hate it. And he wasn't the only person I've talked to that felt this way, thinking it was going to be, you know, it's the Yankees and Manchester City combining forces to create maybe the most evil team in sports history.
The Death Star of the MLS,
yeah. Seriously, but he went to a few matches and he had tons of fun and thought it was, you know, very kind of like old school, before the cheap seats at Yankee Stadium were hundreds of dollars. It was that kind of atmosphere. And I've been seeing a lot of that, I think, around the city. Just people are really getting into this team, even though it turns out that they might be awful as a soccer team on the field.
Yeah, I think he was fortunate to make like the first few games, which they had won. And now they've lost their past two, I believe. And their star, David Villa, had like a groin, and now he's got a hamstring. You know, he's old. And so
this is one of the questions I have about the Red Bulls, which is that with Henry gone, whether or not that means, and them still good, and you know, it's early in the season, as you said, but whether that means that the MLS might finally be moving beyond this phase that it was in, where the only way it could really get people to watch was by bringing in aging Europeans to sort of seed the league with talent, because America didn't have enough talent on its own. And maybe if the Red Bulls, without any big European contracts, are better than the David Villa-led NYFC,
yeah,
whatever it is, then maybe that suggests that the MLS is ready to sort of maybe achieve escape velocity. Kate, are you a soccer woman?
I do. I love soccer. And okay. I can't help but notice the parallels with talking about how the Red Bulls and the other New York football club had these big stars, and right, like Frank Lampard was supposed to play, he couldn't, David Villa's hurt, Red Bulls lose Henry, and they have a bunch of core guys who are just good. Like, there's a total parallel to make there between like the NBA and like the Hawks and the Golden State Warriors, and how they're starting to play in a way where it's like they're developing stars instead of trying to poach them or free agent or draft them. And that's that could be the new model going forward in the NBA. And I think you're totally right, Chad, with the MLS. Like, as it launched itself, it was like, we got to get stars, right? We got to get David Beckham. We got to get these aging guys to just put people in the stands. Well, now MLS is at a point where a number of its franchises, people would almost like fill these stadiums for anybody right now, especially in like Portland, right? And Seattle and those types of places. And I think there's a place in the MLS for American stars always. Like when Clint Dempsey came back, and he's obviously still a really strong player, so like I'm not aging him out of the league. But I think the MLS now should be more about growing American talent and having the MLS be a showcase destination for the national team, and in ways it can be in other countries, and maybe stop sort of trying to poach, you know, 34-year-olds from, you know, France and England.
Okay, that's our significant digit for the week. First place for the Red Bulls of the MLS. And that'll do it for this week's show. Our producer is Jody Avergan. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. You can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps. We're, of course, on iTunes as well. You can subscribe at itunes.com/538. And when you're there, be sure to rate and review the show. Even if you already subscribe, be sure to rate and review the show. It helps others discover the program. Thanks to Allison McCann for coming in. Thanks, Allison.
Thanks for having me.
And Caitlin Kelly, special guest. Thanks, Caitlin.
Thanks for having me.
Kate Fagan all the way from L.A. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks, Chad.
I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.